Good day. Today is Sunday, 24th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, yesterday in my programme, I discussed the response of the Russian authorities and specifically President Putin to the Ukrainian attack on the dormitory building in Starobelsk in Luhansk region. The Russians have said and provided evidence that the building was a dormitory used by students. They've invited the international media there. Some members of the media have apparently visited, though I noticed that the BBC has refused to do so, or so I understand. The Ukrainians, incidentally, claimed that the building in Starobelsk that they attacked was a building that was used and was as some kind of operations centre by Russia's Rubicon group. The evidence doesn't seem to bear that fact out. Perhaps the Ukrainians made a mistake, but so far they're not providing convincing or compelling denials about what actually took place in Starobelsk, or explaining their reasons for their error, if an error did indeed happen. And, well, I have to say this, the same so far continues to be true of the Western media overall. But, well, one of the points that Putin made over the course of his comments about the Starobelsk attack is that Russia would be obliged to take counter action, and last night it did so. And I say that with certain qualifications that I will come to shortly. Anyway, over the course of last night, the Russians carried out what I think is the single most powerful attack on Kiev that they have undertaken up to now. And, well, the Ukrainians have provided their own description of the attack, as has the Russians. And this is what the Russians say, that among the targets hit on 29th May during a massive strike in Kiev and Kiev region by Oreshnik ballistic missiles. Notice that this uses the plural, and this comes from the Russian Defense Ministry's website. They are saying Oreshnik ballistic missiles, plural. Iskander air-launched ballistic missiles, Kinzhal hypersonic air-launched ballistic missiles, and Tsirkon cruise missiles, air, sea, and ground-based cruise missiles, and drones were facilities of the Ukrainian defence industry, military infrastructure, as well as command posts of the General Command of the Ukrainian Ground Forces, the main directorate of intelligence of the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine, and other command posts of the Ukrainian military. And then the Russian Defense Ministry continues, no strikes were planned or carried out against civilian infrastructure in Ukraine. So a number of things from this statement by the Russian Defense Ministry. They say that Oreshnik ballistic missiles, plural, were used. They don't say how many, but the fact that they refer to Oreshnik ballistic missiles in the plural might be taken to mean that more than one was used. They continue that Iskander air-launched ballistic missiles were used, and this is confirmed by the Ukrainians. Kinzhal hypersonic air-launched ballistic missiles were also used, and Tsirkon cruise missiles, which are also hypersonic, were used. Now, the Ukrainians have provided their own information about the number of missiles that the Russians used and the nature of these missiles. They say that one Oreshnik was used, two Kinjals, and three Tsirkon cruise missiles. The Ukrainians admit that none of these hypersonic weapons were shot down. They say that 11, oh, that, sorry, that 30 ballistic missiles were used, and they say that these were a mix of Iskander-Ms and S-400 ballistic missiles. I do not believe that the Russians would use expensive S-400 ballistic missiles that are, in fact, part of an extremely expensive and very advanced air defense system in an attack of this kind. I'm assuming that all of the 30 ballistic missiles were, in fact, Iskanders. The Ukrainians claim, improbably, to have shot down 11. They also claim that a large number of cruise missiles were used, they say 54 in total, of which, again, rather improbably, they say they shot down 44. And they also claim that 600 drones were used, Garand drones, that the Ukrainians insist on referring to them as Shahids, even though by now the Garands have evolved far beyond the original Iranian Shahid missile drone upon which they were based. But anyway, the Ukrainians claim that the Russians launched 600 Garand drones and Garand-type drones, of which the Ukrainians claim that they shot down 549. Well, I am not going to devote much time to discussing Ukrainian claims to have shot down drones and missiles. All I would say is that pictures have appeared from Kiev, and they do appear to be devastating. And they do seem to show large numbers of industrial facilities massively damaged across the city, other buildings also damaged across the city. And well, it's perhaps difficult to give at this time a precise estimate of the damage done, but it does appear to have been very extensive and far more extensive than we've seen in previous Russian attacks. And to say it quickly and straightforwardly, it dwarfs what we have seen from Ukrainian attacks carried out on any location inside Russia. And well, I've seen some reports, which I treat with a great deal of skepticism, that six Ukrainian MPs, members of the Rada, have apparently said on X that the time has come for Ukraine to negotiate peace, and who have supposedly criticized Zelensky. I've seen these reports. I wonder whether they might be Russian misinformation, to say it straightforwardly. I haven't seen these reports up to now, but I wonder whether perhaps in Kiev itself, after an attack of this scale, the Ukrainians, there might be some people in Kiev, probably there already are some people in Kiev, who question the sense and reason in continuing with this war. Now, an attack of this scale and an attack as complex as this cannot be an attack that has been improvised by the Russian military authorities over the space of a few days in response to the attack on the dormitory building in Starobelsk. The Russians have clearly been planning some kind of major missile attack or offensive on Kiev using Oreshnik missiles for a long time. And probably what has happened is that after the Starobelsk attack, Putin came along and asked the military, what can you do? And they brought forward one of the missile strikes that they have already been working on. And it is likely that we are eventually going to see more attacks on Kiev of this sort at some later stage in the conflict. This attack that has just taken place should perhaps be best understood as a foretaste of what is to come. Now, what about the issue of the number of Oreshnik missiles which were used in this attack? The Ukrainians say that only one was used. The Russians leave open the question of whether there might have been more than one. They refer to Oreshnik missiles in the plural. Now, one of the attacks using an Oreshnik missile, in fact, the one confirmed attack using an Oreshnik missile, did not take place against Kiev itself, but at a target or targets located in a small town to the south of Kiev, one of Kiev's outlying satellite towns called Belaya Tserkov. Now, there is massive uncertainty as to what exactly the Oreshnik was attacking in this place. Belaya Tserkov appears to be an industrial suburb. There are apparently large numbers of factories and industrial buildings located there. But the Russian Defense Ministry, in its report, refers to various command centers of the Ukrainian ground forces, which were the target of the attack. Command posts of the Ukrainian, of the General Command of the Ukrainian Ground Forces, the main directorate of the intelligence of the Ministry of Defense of Ukraine, and other command posts of the Ukrainian military. And there's some speculation that these command positions, these places, these command posts were located in this town, the satellite town of Belaya Tserkov. Of course, we don't know. It may be that the Russians, in fact, attacked positions, command posts in Kiev itself, using the other missiles, the Iskanders, the Kinjals, the Tsirkons, those kind of things. We don't actually know what was specifically attacked in Belaya Tserkov or the extent of the damage that was done. When Oreshnik missiles have been used in the past, definitely in Dnipro in November 2024 against the Yuzhmash factory, again against the airfield and airbase near Lvov in January 2026. The Ukrainians have been extremely careful to keep visitors away from the locations of these, of the attack, and to give as little information as possible about the extent of the damage done. And it has only taken, it has taken a very long time since I've seen any footage at all, satellite footage, of the Yuzhmash factory giving some indications of the actual damage done to this factory as a result of the Oreshnik attack of November 2024. We still have the enigma of the a possible attack using an Oreshnik system on Dnipro a couple of days ago, maybe a second attack on the Yuzhmash factory. But that attack has not been confirmed either by the Russians or by the Ukrainians. If that attack did in fact take place, neither the Russians nor the Ukrainians want to talk about it, and the Ukrainians emphatically do not want to show us the damage that was done to the facility in Dnipro. By the way, on that topic, some have pointed to the fact that there have been a large number of flights, apparently to Romania, of aircraft that appeared to be carrying casualties, possibly from some attack in Ukraine. Some people have linked this to the incident in Dnipro a couple of days ago. I think this is all far too sketchy and unreliable to make any, to base any assumptions about, and I just mention it here, but I'm not going to take it further. The point is that we are scarcely ever, we've never been shown proper information, proper evidence of what the effect on a target of an Oreshnik strike actually is. The one thing I can say is that in the aftermath of the strike on the facility close to Lvov, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, did appear to be dismayed and did speak of the importance of NATO developing a system analogous to the Oreshnik, which suggests that the information that he obtained pointed to a strike that did a great deal of actual damage. Anyway, let's not speculate about what we don't really know. I don't know how much damage was done to the facilities in Belaya Tserkov, and I don't know what the Russians were targeting there. But they clearly were targeting something. I don't believe it was just an industrial facility. They could have used other types of weapons to do that. If it was an industrial facility, it was presumably one involved in some very specialised and important work. Indeed, it seems to me nonetheless more likely that these were indeed the command centres, that the Ukrainians, conscious of the constant threat of a possible Russian attack on decision-making centres in Kiev itself, have transferred some of their headquarters personnel to Belaya Tserkov and to these facilities there, and it was those facilities that the Russians were attacking. Now, what about the other Oreshnik missile that some reports claim that the Russians might have used last night? The Russians, as I say, speak of Oreshniks in the plural. The Ukrainians, in effect, deny this. There was apparently some video footage which some took to mean, to indicate an Oreshnik strike on a facility in Kiev itself. I am, of course, unable to confirm that. Well, the short answer is that I don't know. And again, it's unwise to speculate about something that is so controversial, so speculative at the moment. Anyway, there it is, a massive Russian missile strike on Kiev. The key thing is that it did appear to do a very great deal of damage. Some Patriot missiles were launched, from what I can see, mostly ineffectively at the incoming missiles. Overall, however, the air defences in Kiev have failed again. This is a major contrast to what we saw in Moscow some days ago during the massive Ukrainian drone attack against Moscow. The Russians, as I said, over the course of that attack, provided us with a detailed rundown of the structures and facilities that were hit, and most of them were residential buildings, which I doubt, by the way, that the Ukrainians targeted. I suspect the drones were brought down and landed on these buildings by accident. That's my guess. But overall, the Ukrainians failed to penetrate Moscow or do a significant amount of damage there. In this attack, it was otherwise. The Russians were able to break through. In fact, as I said, the air defense of Kiev seems to have failed entirely. And as we can see, a huge amount of damage has been done. I think it is important again to stress that point simply because the Ukrainian drone attacks received so much attention and the Russian missile and drone attacks don't, even despite the fact that there is this massive imbalance in the damage that the Russian, between the Russian drone attacks and the Ukrainian ones. The Ukrainians are sometimes able to damage a particular facility, though the damage is quickly repaired. The Russians do immeasurable damage, and the Ukrainians struggle to repair it in any proximate period of time. Now, this attack on Kiev has happened at roughly the same time that Zelensky and his officials have been constantly warning about a potential Russian advance on Kiev from the north, from Belarus. And interestingly, over the last few days, Zelensky has been talking increasingly about a renewed threat to Kiev, not just from Belarus, but from Russian forces in the north. I suspect that in Kiev now, within the Ukrainian leadership, they are now starting to notice the growing Russian expansion of what the Russians call their buffer zone in Sumy and Kharkiv regions. And they are starting to realize that the city of Sumy, which lies on the main road to Kiev, and which is also, by the way, a major logistical hub for Kharkiv further to the south, that the city of Sumy is now in danger, and further south in Kharkiv, the town of Kupiansk has indeed now been conclusively lost. A couple of days ago, the Russian newspaper Redovka also spoke about how Russian advances from southwards from Volchansk have now managed to capture various Ukrainian positions and villages, which puts the Russians in a strong position to surround and capture a small town in northeastern Kharkiv region called Beli Kolodis, which, if it is indeed captured, would lead to a very significant expansion of the territory in Kharkiv region that the Russians control, and which might potentially, probably next year, lead to a threat to the city of Kharkiv itself. I've discussed often and in many places that for Zelensky himself, the biggest fear, the greatest worry he has in the war is not what happens in Donbass, not even what happens in Zaporozhye region further south, though he does worry about Zaporozhye region and the city of Zaporozhye region quite a lot, but what happens in the north around Kiev itself. The Russians expanding their positions in Sumy and Kharkiv region, threatening the city of Sumy, building up their logistics in Belarus. It may, and apparently it increasingly is looking to him as if the Russians are indeed planning some renewed offensive against Kiev, though this time on a much bigger scale than what we saw back in February 2022. And, well, Zelensky has been talking about this, and he has been talking about Belarus participating in this attack. The president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has strongly denied that Belarus has any intention of participating directly in an operation against Kiev. He has said that Ukraine is spreading false stories about this. He said that Belarus will only take military action if it is itself attacked. And rather remarkably, he has even offered to meet Zelensky in Belarus or even in Ukraine itself to talk this thing through with him and to try to persuade Zelensky that there is no threat to Ukraine from Belarus itself. Zelensky, by the way, has rejected the suggestion of a meeting with Lukashenko. Well, I suspect that Lukashenko is telling the truth in the sense that I don't think that the army of Belarus intends to become involved in an attack on Kiev. I doubt, by the way, that the Russians are asking Belarus to participate in such an attack on Kiev. The Russians don't say very much about these claims from the Ukrainians, from Zelensky, about a potential attack on Kiev. But I noticed that they're not completely ruling out that possibility. But to say it again, I don't think we are anywhere close to the moment when that will come. Before that happens, the Russians will want to clear Donbass and they will want to take control of Sumy and perhaps Kharkiv, the city of Kharkiv, and probably of Zaporozhye as well. And well, there's quite a long time before any of those things happen. And only then, and not before, do I think that the Russians will start thinking about Kiev itself. But Zelensky, who did live through an episode when the Russian army was outside Kiev, who, according to some reports, was in deep fear and alarm during that episode and was hiding in his bunker throughout it. I suspect for Zelensky, this is the ultimate nightmare, worse than the loss of Zaporozhye or even Odessa. If Zaporozhye city is lost, if Odessa is lost and Ukraine is cut off from the Black Sea, It is a catastrophe for Ukraine. It puts in question its future viability as a state. But if Kiev itself, the capital, is lost, then the Ukrainian state, which Zelensky still leads, in effect, as we have known it, is at an end. And for Zelensky also to flee Kiev in advance of a Russian army would be deeply humiliating for him personally and would probably undermine his position as Ukraine's leader. And that also is something that he does not want to do. This attack that we've just seen with Oreshnik missiles, this latest attack on Kiev by the Russians, is going to, I think, deepen Zelensky's underlying alarm. His fear that eventually, at some point, the Russians will come again, only this time with far greater force and far more determination to push the outcome, is going to haunt him. And I suspect it is going to haunt him throughout the rest of the war, and it is likely increasingly to influence his decisions. Now, before I continue with a brief discussion of the state of the war at the present time, I want to turn very briefly to what the deputy chairman of Russia's Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, has said about this big attack, this missile strike on Kiev. He, after all, is the most senior voice in Russia discussing it. And in some ways, what he says is interesting. He says that Zelensky provoked a harsh response from Russia with his attacks on young people. Apparently, he did this on purpose. And Medvedev continues, they need to trigger massive strikes against the structures located in Kiev. Let everything burn with blue flames. It's easier to ask for money and weapons that way. It's easier to steal. It's easier to make more excuses, especially since our strikes can help consolidate part of the electorate around the current Kiev authorities, which of course is important for them in the upcoming elections in that country. I'm not aware, by the way, as to what elections Medvedev is talking about, because as far as I'm aware, there are no elections planned in Ukraine at the moment. But anyway, that's what he said. So, what? Not to strike at all, to avoid provoking and strengthening the regime? No, of course not. We need to strike, as we did today, and even much harder. After all, the ruins and grey ashes in place of their capital's symbols demoralise the enemy, no less than the loss of a battle banner. So that is Medvedev's view, that the Russians ultimately had no choice but to carry out this attack on Kiev. They understand that the attack on Starobelsk was a provocation, or at least that's what they believe, and that it was a provocation intended to provoke an attack of this kind. They also understand that it will solidify support for Zelensky and the Kiev authorities in the West. And by the way, there have already been statements by people like Kaya Kallas and Emmanuel Macron saying exactly this. And I notice avoiding all reference to the incident in Starobelsk. And Medvedev even accepts that the outcome of the strike is that it will lead to some stiffening of support in Ukraine for the current government there, for the regime, for Zelensky himself. But nonetheless, Russia has no alternative in Medvedev's mind but to carry out the strike that we have just seen. And Medvedev also believes that there should be even stronger, more powerful strikes of this kind against Kiev in the future, which, for the record, is what I believe Zelensky himself expects. So anyway, the Russians have made their cost-benefit calculation from this strike, and they've decided that though they've been goaded into it by the Ukrainians, they had no alternative but to go through with it, and that in the end, in future, they will indeed have to heighten their attacks on Ukraine altogether. Well, what else is going on in the war? The Ukrainians, by the way, tried to conduct an attack of their own on Russia yesterday. When I say Russia, I mean Russia within its 1991 borders. From what I can see, this attack, like all the other Ukrainian drone attacks, was mostly ineffective. Some damage to some facilities was done, but nothing, as I said, that cannot be quickly repaired. There's been some talk about Ukrainian drone attacks along the road linking Russia to Crimea that has been built through Donbass and Zaporozhye regions, and the Ukrainians have published footage of this. But as far as I'm aware, this has always been a dangerous road to drive along, and nonetheless vehicles to get through, and most of the supplies to Crimea and most of the supplies to the Russian armies in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions do not go down this road. They use the railways that the Russians have also created in this same region, in Zaporozhye region, and railways are far more difficult to attack in this way. And trains, for the record, are also difficult to attack because, of course, they now carry anti-drone protection. So there's been those things. But in all other respects, the news we're getting from the front lines continues to be negative for the Ukrainians. The reports now appear to confirm the claims made by Redovka, the Russian newspaper, a couple of days ago, that along with Verkhnaya Tersa, the Russians have now also captured the village of Vozvizhevka in eastern Zaporozhye region, and that the remaining fortified village that lies between the Russians and Orekhov, the village of Gulyapolske, is effectively surrounded and likely to fall very soon. The Battle of Orekhov, in my opinion, will begin shortly. And the Russians, and here we have drone footage apparently, have further increased the area that they control in the town of Konstantinovka, where about 10 days ago the tipping point was passed, and where the Russians are now folding or in the process of liquidating one of the two cauldrons that they've established in this area, the one in the south of Konstantinovka, which, once it has been entirely captured, will give the Russians control of all of southwest Konstantinovka, around 40, perhaps even 50%, from what I can judge, of the entire metropolitan territory of the town and the most built up area of the town as well. And that, it seems to me, remains these attacks in these places remain the most important part of the battle at the moment. The blogger Events in Ukraine has now done his own analysis about the situation in the ground war. He has made clear his own skepticism about the various Ukrainian counterattacks that have been taking place over the last few weeks. These, by the way, from what I can see, have been happening entirely in Zaporozhye region, or almost entirely in Zaporozhye region. The Ukrainians have carried out some counterattacks towards Pokrovsk, but these have never got past first base. The Ukrainians have, however, made major efforts to gain ground, first in northeastern Zaporozhye, to try to slow the Russian drive, or reverse the Russian drive, towards Orekhov. The Russians seem to have brushed that offensive aside, and then they switched to trying to push the Russians back in western Zaporozhye along the Dnieper River. Here, the Ukrainians have had some more success, but from what I can see, far from decisive success. And of course, the Russian advance towards Orekhov ultimately is more important. Anyway, Events in Ukraine makes 2 points, each of which, it seems to me, is equally valid. The first is that there is no agreement from the various Ukrainian sources about the counterattacks that have taken place or the amount of territory that the Ukrainians are supposed to have recaptured. DS, the Ukrainian mapping project, shows no advances by the Ukrainians at all. Other projects do show some advances, and Zelensky and Sirsky claim that around 400 square kilometres of territory have been recaptured, but this has been contested by other sources. The Russians, again, this is according to Events in Ukraine, have, however, indisputably achieved their own advances in Donbass, in northern Ukraine, in Sumy region and in Kharkiv region, and to the north of Slavyansk as well. Events in Ukraine, I think I'm summarizing him correctly, believes that Russian advances have been greater than Ukrainian advances, that the Russians have captured more territory over the last few weeks than the Ukrainians have done. About that, by the way, I have no doubt whatsoever. And also, there is no doubt at all in my mind that the territory that the Russians have recaptured is much more important strategically and in the overall course of the battle than what the Ukrainians have recaptured in Zaporozhye over the course of their counterattacks, which I am sure will prove ephemeral. But perhaps the single most important point that Events in Ukraine is making, and with which I completely agree, and which I know that many others agree with too, is that the territory, such as it is, that the Ukrainians have captured, is entirely out of relation, out of proportion to the losses that they have been suffering in seeking to recapture it. And he points out that not only are the Russians at least as heavily equipped with drones as the Ukrainians are, and are able to use drones at least as effectively as the Ukrainians do against attacking forces. In fact, I have no doubt that the Russians use drones more effectively now than the Ukrainians do. But the Russians have an active air force. It is able to drop fab bombs and is doing so in many places. It is bombing, for example, Konstantinovka round the clock. And the fab bombs, which carry orders of magnitude more explosive than even the largest Ukrainian drone does, are almost by definition going to inflict more losses on the Ukrainians than the Ukrainian drones used against the Russians can. And of course, alongside that, the Russians have now still have a clear advantage in artillery. It's completely understandable why the Ukrainians would be suffering much more severe losses than the Russians are. And on the question of Russian losses, events in Ukraine again points out that Ukrainian figures comparing Russian losses this year with the same period last year and comparing Russian losses now with Ukrainian claims of Russian losses in December show no actual increase in Russian losses, despite claims that you sometimes see in the West. If anything, they tend to suggest a fall. Anyway, the point is that Ukraine is short of manpower, Russia is not. Ukrainian counterattacks exacerbate Ukraine's problems with manpower, which the Russians don't share. Putin, in his comments, which I discussed yesterday, spoke about a Ukrainian military situation which is going from bad to critical and soon to catastrophic. I suspect that is what Putin means as well. Anyway, that's the situation in the war at the present time. A massive Oreshnik strike. Probably Ukrainian worries about a potential Russian attack in the future on Kiev. My own view remains that the Russians are focused mostly at the moment on Donbas and Zaporozhye. I suspect that we're going to see events start to move very quickly in those two regions in mid-summer. For the time being, we have seen with this strike using the Oreshnik and the other hypersonic missiles, the power and the damage the Russians can cause in any strike against Ukraine that they put it in their mind to undertaking. Well, that's what I'm going to say about the situation in Ukraine today. Now, I am now going to turn to the other big topic that has been under discussion, because over the last couple of days, there's suddenly been an increase in chatter about an apparent breakthrough in the negotiations between Iran and the United States. I remember that about 2 weeks ago, there were reports about how Iran had sent to the United States a memorandum of agreement which proposed an extension of the current ceasefire for perhaps 30 days. Some now say 60 days, that over the period of that extended ceasefire, the Iranians, while retaining control of the Strait of Hormuz, would nonetheless allow more ships to pass through. The Americans, in return, would lift the sea blockade on Iran, which has proved, by the way, to be, well, perhaps not entirely, but at least to a certain extent, ineffective. And the Americans would also release to Iran a proportion of Iran's frozen assets. The number that I've now been seeing quoted is $25 billion. And there would then be negotiations between Iran and the United States during this 30-day or perhaps 60-day period, leading perhaps to a final agreement on the nuclear enrichment issue. In the meantime, as part of this memorandum of understanding, the United States would commit not to attacking Iran again, and in return, Iran would reiterate, would restate its long-standing commitment, public commitment, that it is not seeking to acquire nuclear weapons, something which Iran, by the way, has been saying for at least 20 years, just to say. So that was, as I understood it, essentially the outlines of the Iranian proposal, the memorandum of understanding that Iran sent to the United States. I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And Donald Trump was furious about it and he rejected it. And at various times, he's suggested that unless the Iranians budge from this position, he's going to reconsider, he's going to restart the war. And there's been talk of the US again launching more strikes against Iran. But the latest word, especially since the visit of Marshal Munir, the Pakistani chief of staff, who set himself up as the mediator, the recent visit to Iran of Marshal Munir, the latest word is that work on this memorandum of understanding continues. And in his public comments, President Trump appears to be giving some support to this. Now, I think this may be true, and I think that the reality is, and has always been, that despite the bravado about restarting the war, President Trump actually is very reluctant to do this. He has been briefed by his military advisors about the disastrous depletion of American military arsenals. There's word this morning from the Financial Times that the United States has had to inform Japan that there will be major delays in supplying Tomahawk missiles already contracted for by Japan because of the depletion in US arsenals. And of course, we know that recently the United States said the same thing to Germany, causing considerable dismay there. So I've always been skeptical that the United States would be able to resume or would want to resume a war against Iran in that way when it is now so short of weapons and when it appears that Iran is not. And we've had statements from a US Navy admiral that the US Navy is not in a position to escort ships through the Strait of Hormuz whilst it is contested, and that it will be far too dangerous to the Navy to do that. So, given that this is all so, I've been skeptical that President Trump has really wanted to restart the war, despite his many threats to do so. So I wonder whether what has happened is that President Trump went to China, met with Xi Jinping, was hoping that the Chinese leader might agree to put pressure on Iran to make more fundamental concessions to the United States than Iran up to now seemed willing to do. And well, what happened when President Trump went to China is that he found that Xi Jinping was not prepared to do that. Instead, what Xi Jinping actually did was give President Trump the strongest warning the United States has ever received from a Chinese leader on the subject of Taiwan. So President Trump went back to the United States. He went back in an angry mood, talk about renewed attacks on Iran restarted, talk about attacks on Cuba restarted as well. But eventually, and after further thought, and maybe after further advice from the United States' Persian Gulf allies, who have pointed out to President Trump the critical situation with their own economies and for the global economy, if the impasse at the Strait of Hormuz remains in place. Well, in light of all of that, President Trump perhaps is starting to see reason and understands that he has to negotiate with the Iranians, that there is no realistic choice, and that makes him look at the memorandum of understanding, which the Iranians and probably the Pakistanis have drawn up with a somewhat more positive view than the one he appeared to have a few weeks ago. The problem is that even if President Trump himself is prepared to accept these realities, all sorts of people in the United States are not. Robert Kagan, the arch neocon, has written a piece in The Atlantic in which he has accused President Trump of preparing to surrender to Iran. And since then, we've had a procession of Republican neocon figures, Senator Lindsey Graham, Senator Ted Cruz, Trump's own former Secretary of State, Michael Pompeo. They're all coming forward and saying that anything less than fulfillment of the US's maximalist demands in Iran, regime change there, the total end of nuclear enrichment, the disarmament of Iran, of what they call the regime, the dismantling of its entire ballistic missile program. Anything short of that is, for the United States, a surrender and a defeat. Well, shortly before I made this program, an article began to circulate in the New York Times, and I believe also in Axios, claiming that as part of the discussions, the Iranians supposedly have agreed that at some point in the future, they will hand over their nuclear stockpile. The implication is to the United States. Now, this is something the Iranians have consistently refused to do in negotiations. The Iranians have at times appeared close or appeared to have considered the possibility of handing over their nuclear stockpile to the Russians, but I cannot imagine that they would seriously want to hand it over to the United States. Nor do I believe that Iran is prepared to agree to a 20-year or 10-year moratorium on nuclear enrichment. And the Tasnim news agency earlier today said categorically that Iran is not. So I suspect that President Trump continues to be under immense pressure from his neocon allies, as they now are, to harden America's stance in the negotiations in order to force or to try to persuade the Iranians into concessions that they have already rejected and which I cannot imagine that they are prepared to agree to now, when they must feel that they are in a position of advantage. I suspect that all of these reports are circulating in part because there continue to be people in the United States who want the negotiations to fail and the war to resume. I hope that they are unsuccessful. Of course, what none of these people, Kagan is something of an exception, but certainly the others, Pompeo, Cruz, Lindsey Graham, what none of these people want to address is how a renewed war is going to be waged by a US military whose stockpiles of weapons are now so depleted. It has been a consistent issue with the neocons that they discount resources and capability and reduce everything to a question of will. I hope that President Trump does not listen to these bad counsels. If he does, then it's likely that the negotiations will indeed fail. The Iranians are already saying that there are disagreements between them and the Americans, and Iran is prepared for the possibility that the negotiations might indeed fail. In which case, the United States will find itself again locked into a war, which it could quite easily lose. And all of this, even as the situation in global energy markets and in the world economy goes from bad to worse. The inability of the neocons to deal with reality has been the major disaster in American foreign policy over the last 30 years. And their lock grip on American foreign policy, which continues undiminished, well, makes that disaster greater still. Well, Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. There's a major sale going on our shop, by the way, which you absolutely need to look at. And last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.